Center Point Church, who are we? We are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to the day when the rule of God covers the earth. Amen? Well, good morning to you. It's great to be with you again, and looking forward to a good time together as we submit to the Word of God. As you've already heard, and no doubt noted on your calendar, it is 2016. It is. It's the first week of 2016. It's the first Sunday of this new year. And over this next week, those of us who are students or are teachers or professors working with students, we know that this is a big week because people will start poring over those syllabi in anticipation of the semester ahead. There'll be a little grumbling and moaning and complaining and oh no, but overall, there's actually a tremendous sense of anticipation. And people will map out their schedules. They'll think about the assignments that they are going to have due. They will begin to imagine what it will be like to do exactly what the professor says and perform well so that 15 weeks, 16 weeks from now, they're going to get a really good grade. That's what's happening this week. But I have to tell you, there's a group of my students this week who are going to have a slightly different experience. For you see, it was 15, 16, 18 weeks ago that they were poring over their syllabi with the same anticipation that they would do really well. And the semester went along, and now they're about to receive a letter from me. It'll be a sad letter, and they'll be quite disappointed, some of them. Because you see, what the letter will say is that, yes, I received your last couple of assignments, but they are rejected. Can't accept them. In fact, I won't even read them. How could that happen? They did all the work. They followed the instructions perfectly. They may have written very good papers. They did everything they needed to do except for one thing. They submitted it late. After the semester was over, it popped into my inbox. They thought they could sneak it under the wire. Rejected. Unacceptable. Can't take it. I feel bad for those students. But not nearly as bad as I will feel for my brothers and sisters at Center Point and for myself if we received a letter from God that said about us and our work, rejected. Unacceptable. What, you say? Couldn't happen. Well, that's just what my students thought. You see, my students, they actually knew the date when everything had to be submitted. But I suppose that along the way, that while they understood what was required, well, they got a little bit busy, they got a little lax, and they began to think about their professor. He's a generous guy. He extends a lot of mercy. I've handed in some other things late, and he still accepted it. And everything's kind of cool with him. We'll be able to just get in the work when we want to. He overlooks a lot. But the sad truth is, their work is rejected. Perhaps sometimes we look at our God as an endlessly merciful, always gracious, generous professor who overlooks everything, always. And perhaps like my students, we can become a bit complacent about our obedience. We slide into a sense of entitlement that his goodness will always be ours regardless. And then we hear it rejected, set on a shelf, disqualified from service, no longer really usable because of a problem with obedience. You may think that such a thing could never happen with God. But our message this morning forces us to focus on this reality, that incomplete obedience to God invites rejection from God. Incomplete or partial obedience of God invites rejection from God. How could that be? Well, that's what we're going to explore this morning. And we're going to look very carefully at a text that describes how there's a sad story of a king, a tragic story of a king and a nation who thought they'd never be rejected, but they found out that their partial, incomplete obedience invited just such a response from God. And then we'll look at a couple of responses that we should make from that text. Something to believe, something that we need to drive deep into the core of our beings. And then an action or two that we can take. So it'll be a great journey as we walk through this sad, tragic, but most instructive text from 1 Samuel 15. So I invite you to turn there with me, if you will, 1 Samuel chapter 15. We're back to our series that we began in September on pursuing together the blessings of God. And I trust that you will find this word from God to be challenging and helpful for your lives. 1 Samuel chapter 15, we're going to begin in verses 1 through 3, and we're going to see that in the midst of mission, God's people are tempted to obey partially. In the midst of our mission with God, God's people are tempted to obey incompletely. And we see this in the experience of King Saul, a man who is going to be sent on a mission from God, a holy mission, a great mission. And his response is not quite full obedience. Follow along as I read 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 1 through 3. Notice the mission that God gives to Saul. 1 Samuel 15, 1 says, "Samuel said to Saul, 'I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to literally the word of the Lord.' This is what the Lord Almighty says. 'I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now, go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women and children and infants, cattle and sheep and camels and donkeys.'" Saul, I have a job for you, a mission, a holy mission. And I want you to be my tool for justice. God, through Samuel, sends Saul on this mission. And before he does, he reminds him of his calling. He says to him, Samuel says to Saul, "Look, I'm the one who anointed you as king from God, king over God's people," right? In verse 1. "This is your very privileged rank, a very special position as God's leader over his people. And with this rank, I'm going to give you a very special mission, fighting the Amalekites." In fact, even before he gets to the specifics, he reminds him that the mission of this king is to listen to the word of the Lord. Notice how he says it right there at the end of verse 1. So listen now to the, and the NIV translates that, message. Listen literally to the sound of the words of the Lord. Remember that. It will come back. The sound of the words of the Lord. That's what this king is supposed to do. And now the specifics come. He's going to go and he's going to fight against the Amalekites, these people, and he's going to destroy them completely. In fact, it's really stressed here in the text. Did you notice? Four different ways the author says he wants the total annihilation of these people. Notice again, back in verse 3, he uses the word attack them, totally destroy them, do not spare them, put to death men and women and cattle and everything. The emphasis is on complete obliteration of the Amalekites. But that's not just some war to benefit Israel. You see, God is not picking on the Amalekites just so he can be the big bad bully. God is not seeking the destruction of the Amalekites just to benefit Israel. No, there's something bigger going on here. This is holy war. This is a war that God has declared would happen from ages past. In fact, the word that he uses here is actually a very technical term. This word that the NIV puts in here as totally destroy. It's actually a word that means put them under the ban. Make them devoted to the Lord. And only two ways to be devoted to the Lord. Either one is completely devoted to the Lord by their own will, or they're devoted to the Lord by their destruction. Happens several times in the Old Testament. So this is a term what God is saying. There's going to be holy war against the Amalekites. I want you to totally destroy them. Well, how can a merciful, kind, loving, compassionate God command Saul and the Israelites to do that? Well, he's not unjust to call for the deaths of women and children, although to us today it kind of seems that way. If you notice back there earlier in the text, verse 2, it says that these are the people who opposed Israel as they were coming out from Egypt and headed toward the land of Canaan. These are the people who stood in the way and they put up a blockade. And in fact, they fought against Israel when Israel was most vulnerable. And it was in those days that God promised through Moses that one day the Amalekites will be totally destroyed, eliminated, the memory of them forgotten. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 25, where Moses speaks to the generation that's going to enter the land, he says this: remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt, when you were weary and they worn out, and they met you on your journey and attacked all of you who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he's giving you to possess in the inheritance, you shall blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. So you see, now in Saul's day, hundreds of years later, these descendants of the Amalekites are connected to the original sinful, God-hating people. And God says, it's time. So he gives to Saul this opportunity, this privileged mission to be his instrument of justice. A holy mission from God. Wow. To fulfill a prophecy from long ago. Tough, but indeed a privilege, a mission for Saul to fulfill, to be a tool of God's judgment. Well, how does Saul do? He obeyed. Partially. The story continues in verses 4 through 9. Notice what it says about Saul's obedience. Verse 4, so Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 from Judah. This is a big army. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, go away, leave the Amalekites so that I do not destroy you along with them, for you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites moved away from the Amalekites. So far, so good. Saul seems to immediately obey. He gets the troops together. He plans an ambush. He takes the innocent people, the Kenites, and moves them out. So all you have left now are the Amalekites. Let's get them. Verse 7. So Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur, near the eastern border of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive. And all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle and the fat calves and the lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, unwilling to put under the ban that God had declared. But everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. You see, Saul demonstrated incomplete obedience. He obeyed, but not all the way. And in fact, the emphasis of the text is on this reservation of Saul. Unwilling, the text says. Did you see it? Unwilling to do what God had commanded. In fact, they destroyed, but then they kept Agag alive, and they preserved the best of the cattle and the best of the livestock. Saul's obedience was only partial. He didn't finish the job. But let's not just scold Saul here. Let's just pause for a moment and ask of ourselves, are we tempted to engage in similar behavior? Are there points in our lives when we are pursuing God's holy work and we are also tempted to an incomplete obedience, a partial obedience? I'd suggest yes. You see, we are on a holy mission, are we not? A holy mission sent out to represent Jesus to the world. We are image bearers of God, a holy mission that God has called us to and that we are engaged in every day. And as Saul and Israel represented God to their world, so we represent our God. We represent Jesus to our world, to be lights in a world of darkness, to be priests to the people of the world, to be image bearers of our Creator. We are on holy mission. And we are tempted for partial obedience. Oh, for us, the sound of the word of the Lord is not to kill Amalekites, but the sound of the word of the Lord is for other actions. The word of the Lord is for us to be, for example, sexually pure. But we're tempted by a partial obedience, to partial obedience by a world that's full of sexual looseness. Our world not only considers immorality to be acceptable, but even desirable. And it woos us to join in. And we're tempted to partial obedience. Or our holy mission is to, from the word of the Lord, to have husbands who love their wives as Christ loved the church, and wives who will submit to their husbands, all as a way of portraying this holy mission to the world of what the relationship between God and His people is to be like. But as husbands, we were tempted to a partial obedience. It's not hard to love her when she's lovable, but then there are those times when she's not so lovable. And perhaps we struggle to obey then. Or for our wives who will submit and submit and submit until finally they just get tired of submitting to a man who does not acknowledge that submission and makes it incredibly difficult, and it's laborious and exhausting, and finally there is no longer submission. Incomplete obedience. We're tempted. Or on our holy mission, the word of the Lord comes to us and says to be generous with what we have been given. So we'll give some money to the church and give some more money to help a friend, but then the money starts to run short and fear will grab us and we begin to hold back, preserve for ourselves. We're tempted to be less generous and our obedience becomes partial, incomplete. So we're not far from Saul and Israel. Like them, on a holy mission for our God, we're tempted to an incomplete obedience. Well, what happened when Saul obeyed incompletely? When Saul was partially obedient, how did God respond? Well, Saul and his army, they marched and they waited and they attacked. They did so many things well. They killed hundreds, even thousands of people. They may have destroyed hundreds or even thousands of animals and livestock. I mean, what kind of grade would you give Saul? It sounds like, he's like 95%, 97%. That's an A where I teach. Or maybe an A minus. Surely that's a passing grade. He's been mostly obedient, or so it seems. But God's assessment will come in very strong terms, and he will say, because you have rejected me, I have rejected you. When Saul is partially obedient, God rejected him as king. We begin back in chapter 15, notice verse 10. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king. I regret, God says, that I have made Saul king. Because he's turned away from me and he has not carried out my words, the word of the Lord. Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Regret. It certainly carries the idea of sorrow. It is this sense that things should not be this way. It does not mean that God has made a mistake. But what it means is that God is about to change direction. He's been going this direction with Saul as king. And the statement basically means, with sorrow, I'm going to move in another direction. We see this word one other place in the Old Testament where it's used of God so profoundly, where God says in Genesis chapter 6, having watched the sin begin to envelop his world and invade every crevice of creation, God looks down and he says, I regret that I have made mankind. And it's the last statement before he does an uncreation by sending the flood. So God will look down at Saul and he says, I regret that I have made Saul king. I'm going to do an unking of Saul. Reverse direction. And so there is this sad story that unfolds of how Samuel in his anguish cries out probably over the tragic nature of the whole affair. And then he has to go and announce to Samuel this rejection. Verses 12 and following. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul. But he was told, Saul has gone to Carmel, where he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone on down to Gilgal, the proud warrior. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, the Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions. I love it. Saul sees, he's perhaps near his tent, and he gets word that, hey, the old prophet, Samuel, he's coming, you need to go meet him. So Saul runs out, and he is excited. Hey, Samuel, Lord bless you. I have done exactly what the Lord commanded me to do. He's probably expecting high fives from Samuel. He's ready to do a victory dance. He probably says to Samuel, look, I just came from Carmel where I built a victory monument. It's a picture of me, but all the people remember how God has given us victory this day. Isn't it wonderful? And then he looks at Samuel. His face is long and drawn. And his eyes are red from crying all night. And as they begin to walk back to the tent, where King Saul is so excited, says, Samuel, I can make you feel better. We'll put you in the massage chair. We're gonna give you some Gatorade. This is just a great day for celebration. And Samuel stops. What's this sound I hear? And with one question, the whole mood changes. Verse 14, then Samuel said, "What is this bleating of sheep in my ears?" Literally, what is this sound of sheep in my ears? What is the sound of cattle that I hear? Gotcha. It was the sound of the Lord's voice, the sound of the Lord's word that was to be taking Saul forward in mission. And now the text says, it's the sound of sheep and cattle that demonstrate his disobedience. Samuel confronts Saul with the verdict that he's rejected. Verse 15, Saul answered, "The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites." The soldiers, not me. It was the soldiers. They brought them. They, you know, they're the ones who, they grabbed all these cattle and these livestock. They brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God. See, we had good motives. They brought it, but it was all to be sacrificed later, Samuel. But we totally destroyed all the rest. 90% obedience. Verse 16, the Vic Free translation here goes like this. Samuel said to Saul, "Shut up." Actually, we don't know how to translate this word here, so it's translated differently in every version you'll find. "Quit talking, because you're babbling nonsense, Saul." Verse 16, "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Let me tell you the word of the Lord. It's going to come again." "Tell me," Saul replied. Samuel said, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, perhaps too small to do what you should do as king, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel." You didn't act like it. "He sent you on a mission saying, 'Go and completely destroy these wicked people, the Amalekites. Wage war against them until you have wiped them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord?" Why did you not obey the Lord? "Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" But "I did obey the Lord," Saul said. "I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, the king. The soldiers, they took the sheep and the cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Notice the attempts that Saul makes to justify himself. "Hey, I did what was all right, and the problem was really with the army. I listened to them." Oops. Who are you supposed to listen to, Saul? You're supposed to listen to the sound of the word of the Lord. And Saul says, "I listened to the sound of my army. And I did what they wanted. And I just left Agag alive. But we were going to sacrifice the animals anyway. See, it's okay." Verse 22 comes to the heart, the theological heart of the text. But Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord?" The answer, no. To obey is better than sacrifice. To heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. You are acting like an idolater. You are acting like someone who is seeking guidance outside of the direct word of the Lord, a diviner. It's sin, it's evil, it's rebellion, it is rejection of the word of the Lord. And that's how he concludes his statement, the end of verse 23. "Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." Saul's caught in partial obedience. And the penalty in this case will be justice from God. Talionic justice. It means the punishment fits the crime. You see it in verse 23. You'll see it again in verse 26. "You have rejected me. I will reject you." Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that Paul's no longer considered an Israelite? No. Does that mean that God will no longer care for Saul? No. Does that mean God hates Saul and has kicked him out of the family? No. It means the privileged position that God has given to Saul as king of his people, his role in this holy mission, has been stopped. And the rest of this book is about Saul being replaced, put on the shelf, booted from the game, taken out of action. This chapter finishes with three wonderful little illustrations of the severity of this rejection. We won't take time to read it all, but in the verses that follow, you can read through them later today. You'll see that Saul begs for forgiveness, and Samuel says, no, no. God changed his mind. He repented once, but he's not repenting on this one. He's not changing his mind on this one. You will not be king. And so as Samuel turns to leave, Saul will grab his robe and it tears. Illustration one, just as my robe has torn, Samuel says, the kingdom will be torn from you. Samuel is going to take his sword and he will find that king Agag. And the text says that he will execute the justice of God by chopping him to pieces. Not Saul, Samuel will take up the sword. Saul's mission is done. And then the end of the text, you'll find when you read it, it says that Samuel and Saul parted ways, and Samuel never saw him again. They'll actually see each other, but Samuel will never see him again as a prophet to bring to him the word of the Lord. God is done with him. The last statement of the verse repeats where this section began. Look at verse 35, the last line. And the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. That's the same line we started with back in verse 10. Bookends for God to say, enough. When Saul's obedience was incomplete, God rejected him as king. A tragic story, sad story, but one written for our benefit. For indeed, our response must be, first of all, to believe in the very depths of our soul, that when our obedience, as we engage on a holy mission for God to represent him to this world, when our obedience is partial and incomplete, we invite the very justice of God. When we pursue God's mission with incomplete obedience, we run the risk of rejection from God. Now, what is this rejection? Please understand, we're not saying it's rejection from the family of God. God doesn't throw us out. We're not saying it's a loss of salvation. God doesn't end our relationship with him. We're not saying it's rejection as objects of God's love and faithfulness. That will never end. But it is a rejection from our participation in the very mission of God, that he sets us on the sidelines off the playing field. And God says, you don't represent me anymore. Hard to believe that. God is gracious, loving, faithful, wonderful, merciful. It's true. And it's even hard to tell when God does that today. My job is not to figure it out. It's to proclaim what's here. Our partial obedience is not looked upon lightly by our God. We sense that there are times when there is a line that is crossed and God says, enough. A man cheats on his wife, gives in to immorality, loses his marriage, and that marriage can no longer be used as a part of the display of God's beauty to the world. It's enough. It's the end of it. Perhaps the one who is materially blessed refuses to be generous, and God may one day say, fine, you want to hoard your prosperity? Go for it. And he loses himself in mindless pursuit to the point where it drives him crazy. Maybe that's how God sets us on a shelf. Or perhaps it can happen in different ways where he removes us from our privilege and he gives us our own pursuits and perhaps even brings us to an early death. I don't know all the way God works. But I know this. We must believe it. That partial obedience for those of us who are on mission with God invites his rejection, his justice. So what do you do going forward? What a great day to resolve to obey completely. To say in 2016, what I want for me, what I want for my family, what we want for our church is a level of obedience that we've never had before. May God help us. That we would move forward serious about the commands of God. Never willing to settle for a partial obedience in our marriages, in our work, in the way that we handle money, in the way that we look at relationships. Oh, it's okay if I marry her. I mean, she's an unbeliever, but you know, if I marry her, maybe she'll come to know the Lord. My friends, God delights not in sacrifice, but in obedience. Pursue God's mission in complete obedience. I don't know where you are tempted to demonstrate partial obedience. Maybe at the office, maybe in your sexual life, maybe in your money. But today would be a great day for you to say, I want to really be serious with the Lord in 2016. I'm going to ask Carolyn and Wayne to come and lead us in a hymn of commitment. But as Carolyn plays just the first verse of Just As I Am, I want to invite you to do business with God. Some of you, you'd say, you know, I really haven't been obedient at all. It's not a matter of partial obedience. I don't even follow Jesus. Today would be a great day for you, my friend, to cling to this one who has paid for all your sins and offers you entrance to the family free with grace. Come to him just as you are. For the rest of us, let's pray for a moment, silently, committing ourselves that we would come to Jesus with a new level of commitment to obedience.